It's Thursday, April 4th, and in a place known for earthquakes, they hadn't seen anything like this in a generation. We start here. A deadly earthquake rocks Taiwan.
We saw entire buildings collapsing.
Rescue workers are still examining buildings. We'll get the latest. Farmers had been worried about bird flu. Now the nation's largest egg producer has to shut down.
It can be highly contagious. It evolves rapidly.
So should you be worried for either your health or your wallet? And World Central Kitchen workers wouldn't have even been driving across Gaza were it not for this.
Israel can't just get rid of a UN agency. I mean, that would have to come from many more member states.
The controversial dispute over food comes front and center. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. The scary thing about a natural disaster on an island is there's no place to hide. If something happens on one side of the island, everyone feels the impact. Taiwan sits right next to mainland China. It's about 100 miles off the coast. The island itself is about the size of Maryland, and it's got quadruple the population. Well, yesterday, Taiwan experienced its largest earthquake in 25 years. At least 9 are dead, more than 900 people injured. Just gives you a sense of how widespread the damage was. And ABC's foreign correspondent Marcus Moore has been tracking it all. Marcus, first off, what can you tell us about the earthquake?
Well, hey, Brad, this was really a very powerful pair of earthquakes that unfolded yesterday. Right around rush hour, just a couple of minutes before 8 o'clock, and it shook for quite some time, and the shaking was felt across the entire island. So if that gives you some sense of how significant this was. The first quake was said to be a 7.2 magnitude earthquake and had a depth of about 21 miles, which is actually considered a shallow earthquake. And then the second one was a 6.5, and it had a depth of about 7 miles. And so that's one of the reasons why we saw entire buildings collapsing. Talking about a 5-story building where the first floor collapsed and then the building is left tilted at 45 degrees. We've seen videos of people running for their lives, really, amidst the shaking, running through the streets, trying to find some place where they felt safe. And then there were a number of landslides that came as a result of the shaking, and at least 3 tsunamis, including one that reached the southern islands of Japan. There was no damage there, but it does speak to just the far-reaching impacts of these earthquakes.
What does the rescue effort look like there?
Well, overnight, there has been this urgent rescue effort. People have been trapped in these buildings and in structures, and also in other parts of the country, including a pair of rock quarries, where we've been following developments where searchers have been trying to reach about 70 miners who were trapped after the shaking. And then there are tourists, Brad, who were reportedly visiting a cave, a popular cave, and crews were trying to reach them to determine if they were safe and okay.
It felt like it was up and down shaking in the beginning, and then it started really shaking side by side.
There were a number of tourists who were impacted. This happened in the eastern part of Taiwan, not as heavily populated as other parts of the country, but certainly a destination for a number of tourists. The Hualien area where the epicenter was for the first quake is really a quiet tourist destination, a tourist town there. So it gives you a sense of kind of how this earthquake really shattered the peace and the tranquility there. And now we've watched this catastrophe unfold.
And this is a part of the world that has seen many, many earthquakes in the past, right? I mean, how did this compare with what Taiwan has seen before, I guess?
Yeah, Taiwan sits on the Ring of Fire that we've all learned about in school and may have heard about from past earthquakes. A very active part of the world for seismic activity. Taiwan sits there. And yeah, there have been very strong earthquakes in the past in the same area, including one in 1999 that, if you recall, killed sadly more than 2,000 people, up to 2,400 people. this earthquake, as tragic and as horrendous as it has been, resulting in the deaths of at least 9 people and injuring more than 1,000, we're not at this point seeing a situation like what we saw in 1999. And I think that speaks to the improvements that have been made in terms of the infrastructure improvements throughout Taiwan and the preparedness as well. But in the same breath, when you talk about the success that has been made, authorities are still facing at this hour a real challenge in trying to clear roadways that have been blocked from the landslides or that have split open from the shaking. So as much work as they have done to try to protect lives and property in Taiwan from earthquakes, these are still very powerful things. And we've watched it time and time again when Mother Nature deals a very hefty blow to various parts of the world.
Yeah, and you mentioned the part of the world. I mean, this island sits directly on a fault line. That's actually why the western part of the island has been hit so hard so many times before. This one on the east side. Marcus Moore reporting on all this. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brad. Always good to be with you.
Next up on Start Here, is this more of the same, or is a new bout of bird flu extra worrisome? What you need to know after the break. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November, and while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here. If you went egg shopping for your Easter egg hunt this past weekend, you may have noticed you were paying a little bit more for those sunny-side-up ingredients. Prices have been rising for the last few months. Well, some are worried that could all get worse soon because of a new outbreak of bird flu.
Tonight, the CDC is closely tracking bird flu across the country after a confirmed case in a Texas dairy farm worker.
So over the last couple years, this virus has infected 80 million birds across the country, including millions of laying hens. Now this latest surge has impacted the nation's largest producer and distributor of fresh eggs. It's called Cal-Maine Foods. And they said after detecting bird flu in their Texas flocks, they had to cull nearly 2 million of their hens and shut down operations. Sony Salzman from ABC's medical unit is here. Sony, I mean, can you put this in perspective for me? How big of a deal is this?
Brad, the reason that we are talking about bird flu this week is because bird flu has been found in poultry farms and egg-producing facilities in Michigan and Texas. And in that Texas poultry farm that you mentioned, they are ceasing operations to try to deal with this. And that company, Cal-Maine, is behind major brands like Farmhouse Eggs, Land O'Lakes, and they've halted production in that Texas plant, which is raising alarms. Now, another big headline here is that bird flu has not just been found in birds. We've known that bird flu circulates in birds. That's why it's called bird flu or avian flu. But what we're seeing now is that 11 cattle herds, so cows, have also been found with the virus. And this week, a man in Texas who was in close contact with one of those herds, he also was infected with bird flu. So now you're talking not just about birds, bird flu circulating in birds, but you're also talking about birds in two other species, which is cattle and humans.
Yeah, when you say humans, I mean, what is, this seems like a basic question, what is bird flu and how is it different from the regular flu? Like what, I mean, how dangerous is it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So bird flu is a strain of flu. It's in the same family, influenza. You know, every year we have cold and flu season in our human population, right, Brad? And bird flu is a similar thing. It circulates widely in poultry populations in wild birds. So, you know, it can be highly contagious. And there have been some instances of people getting infected with bird flu, but typically it's people who work with poultry, work with animals, and it doesn't spread amongst human populations. But what I will say,
like,
Brad—
like human to human doesn't happen, but bird to human has happened before.
Exactly. And okay. What I will say is that if human to human were to be happening, that is something that the public health establishment would be taking very seriously. And I will say they're taking this very seriously.
This is the first time we're seeing it in cattle. And the fact that it spread to one human case is certainly making us want to take this very seriously.
The CDC director, Mandy Cohen, is coming out this week and saying, you know, this is right now the risk to the public is low, but they are on top of this. They are monitoring this.
CDC and partners on the ground are working hard to make sure we're understanding the situation and working to keep that risk level low.
To make sure that there's no further spread and nothing to be concerned about when it comes to our human health.
Well, and so then when we look at the viral risks, when we look at the economic risks of culling this many birds and telling farmers to keep an eye on this, how do authorities decide then when it's okay to resume operations at these poultry plants? Like, when do you give the green light?
Yeah, so authorities are going to be monitoring very carefully to make sure that animals in those flocks are not infected. And they will make a call about when those facilities can come back online if their animals are clear. But I want to be clear, this is not a one and done thing. Right now, birds are migrating. You know how I mentioned this is in wild birds? So birds are migrating. They're flocking, right? And so what that means is that they are flying over chicken farms and poultry farms in the U.S., and they leave their droppings, and you have to consistently monitor this. So this is not something that public health swoops in to look at all of a sudden. They have a lot of experience working with this bird flu. And in fact, it's something that Mandy Cohen, the CDC director, told us is that, you know, that's something that makes her feel confident is the level of experience that they have working with this.
So it's different than, for example, where we were with COVID, where it was a brand new virus where we had never seen that before. We've seen this virus before. We've seen it in poultry before.
So, you know, there's a lot of considerations here. What I think for everyday Americans, it's going to be, how scared should I be for my human health? Right now, CDC Director Mandy Cohen says risk to the public is low. And then what is the impact going to be on the economy potentially?
Right.
What is the impact going to be of all these poultry flocks having to be culled? And that's a question where time is really going to tell. Our colleagues have been speaking to economists who say that in the near term, this is not expected to impact, for example, egg prices, but it's something that we'll have to kind of watch and see how these outbreaks unfold in these animal populations.
I see. And I guess important to note then that the CDC basically says no infected animals are making it to market. In any case, this virus would be cooked out of your meat. So good reminder to cook your poultry, cook your beef to proper temperatures. Sonny Salzman, really useful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Brad.
The war in Gaza has already claimed the lives of 30,000 Palestinians, more than 1,000 Israelis. In terms of numbers, you might not think 7 aid workers would necessarily tip the scales. But the Israeli airstrike that killed these workers from World Central Kitchen has become a flashpoint, not just between Israel and Gaza, but between Israel and the rest of the world.
What I know is that we were targeted deliberately.
Chef Jose Andres, who in recent years has gone from a restaurant owner to charity superpower, described to Reuters the anger he felt about his workers being effectively targeted, whether accidental or not, by the government that was supposed to be escorting them around Gaza.
It's not a war against terrorism anymore. Seems this is a war against humanity itself.
That sentiment is being echoed not just by fellow chefs, but by government officials in several countries. And part of what has all made this so desperate is that Gaza's other main source of food aid, the group that's been there for decades, has effectively been deemed illegal by Israel. The Israelis won't work with them. The World Central Kitchen was supposed to step in as a stopgap. Well, this disaster has led to renewed calls asking, why is Israel in a position to decide which aid organizations distribute food in Gaza anyway? Even before the catastrophe, ABC's foreign correspondent Tom Sufi Burge has been reporting this out. He joins us now. Tom, first of all, can you just give us a sense of how bad the food situation has become in Gaza leading up to this?
Yeah, Brad, aid agencies say that the situation is critical, that the level of malnourishment amongst the population in Gaza, and in particular in northern Gaza, is chronic. We're not officially into a famine, but the UN is warning that we will hit a famine in Gaza within the next few weeks.
Children are dying from the combined effects of malnutrition and disease and lack of adequate water and sanitation.
Probably the biggest issue is not actually getting food aid into Gaza. It's actually distributing food aid around the strip. The UN agency on the ground, UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, has been like a government in Gaza and other parts of the Middle East, crucial in the distribution of aid throughout this war. But the thing is, though, UNRWA's very existence now is in question.
Yeah, tell me more about UNRWA, because I think most Americans are not familiar with the acronym, right? But United Nations, you know what the UN stands for. And yet this has become an incredibly divisive group inside and outside Israel.
Yeah, it was set up in 1949. So, you know, basically when the State of Israel came into being. It has been providing education, healthcare, other basic services like collecting the trash in Gaza, in the West Bank, even in parts of Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon.
And UNRWA is huge, right?
UNRWA is huge. UNRWA is the largest UN agency. We have 33,000 area staff.
We talked to Adam Baloukas. He's from New York, and he's a director at UNRWA.
We're probably in the most politically complex environment, but we're apolitical as an agency. We don't have a political mandate.
The U.S. has paused funding to the UN agency that is actually providing aid to the Palestinians after the stunning allegation.
In the weeks after the October 7th terror attack in southern Israel, it emerged that 16 members of UNRWA, employees, are alleged to have participated, according to Israel, in the attack.
The five-page intelligence report accuses some of the UN workers of kidnapping while placing others at the scene of massacres, and at least one moved weapons for Hamas.
The Israelis have released some audio recordings backing up some of their claims. There is also a video which allegedly shows an UNRWA employee helping to move the body of a dead Israeli man, a young man called Jonathan Samarano, moving his lifeless body on October the 7th into allegedly an UNRWA vehicle.
And it smells.
It smells of your son.
Yes, this is the smell.
And why was he having this costume, Harry Potter costume?
For a poem.
Right.
We spoke to the mother of Jonathan Samarano, Eilat.
Wherever he went, people wanted to be with him, to be next to him. It was like a magnet of people.
Now, UNRWA says it can't verify that video, but it is urging the Israelis to pass all evidence they have to the UN investigation.
I'm not a politician or I'm not an investigator. I just know what's happened with my son. And I know that the one that took my son is UNRWA worker.
And that seems serious. People are saying that these workers were involved in terror attacks, the biggest terror attack Israel's ever seen. Is that true?
UNRWA does not deny the severity of those allegations. It quite clearly says this is a major issue. We have to look into it. A thorough independent investigation by the UN's watchdog has to clear this up.
Now, we all agree that the actions on the 7th of October were horrible.
I mean, listen to Adam Baloukas. He's a director at UNRWA.
So the first thing that the Commissioner General did after discussing with the Secretary General in New York and then with key donors, including those in Washington, he terminated the employment of those individuals.
The Israeli government has said those allegations against those individuals, those 16 individuals, is proof in the Israeli government's mind that there's a wider problem. What the Israeli military have also published are videos which they say show UNRWA food supplies discovered in Hamas tunnels throughout the course of the war. In one video, the Israeli military show weaponry coming out of an UNRWA sack. Now, UNRWA's response to the food supplies is that they haven't ever supplied food to Hamas. And they say that these sacks are pretty commonplace, and they say they are used, reused by people and used to store other things.
Who in their right mind would let this organization continue dealing with humanitarian aid?
We spoke to Ophir Falk. He's an advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Anybody who truly wants prospects for peace must understand that Hamas must be destroyed, UNRWA must be dissolved, and our hostages must be freed.
And the Israeli government has been saying this before October the 7th, but it's really now pushing this argument for the dissolution of UNRWA.
So it makes me wonder, though, then, Tom, as to what Israel sees as the future of food aid in Gaza, whether it's through this war or even after this war. If Israel's saying the main group that's been providing food and services for decades isn't good enough, what is good enough for them?
Well, this is why it matters so much, right? I mean, aid agencies are warning of this looming famine. Other NGOs that we've spoken to say, look, UNRWA for us was vital. Like, we got data about the broad humanitarian picture on the ground from them.
They employ 13,000 people in Gaza. I mean, we are talking about a massive agency.
Dr. Tahir Ahmed from MedGlobal, the American NGO, says you just can't cut UNRWA out of the process.
There is not a single agency on the ground in the Gaza Strip right now that can replace what UNRWA is doing. No one, not even if all of the NGOs combined came together, would be able to replicate what they're doing on the ground.
Yes, Israel is calling for UNRWA to be disbanded, but it won't come down to Israel's decision. I mean, this... you know, Israel can't just get rid of a UN agency. I mean, that would have to come from many more member states. What the Israelis have managed to do is spark a debate in Washington. Many Republicans, some Democrats even, pushing for the end of UNRWA. And now Congress has effectively blocked any more US money for UNRWA for at least a year.
How critical financially are things now?
It looks like we have funding through the end of April. And that's very, very tight.
And that really matters because previously, American money was about 30 to 40% of UNRWA's entire budget.
Right. And some of these allies apparently are resuming their payments, but the U.S. is not. And the entire reason these other groups like World Central Kitchen, the entire reason those workers were out there is because Israel said, we're not going to work with the folks at UNRWA anymore. And now we're seeing the implications within days of some of these funding decisions. Tom Sufi Burridge, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, as if a marathon wasn't taxing enough, one last thing is next.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing, the streets can be rough, the streets can be dangerous, but recently the streets are getting expensive. Yesterday we learned that New York officials are telling the famed New York City Marathon that it wants more money. Specifically, they're saying they want $750,000, kind of a marathon tax, in return for the marathon shutting down a huge toll bridge. Every year, instead of being filled by cars, the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, which goes from Staten Island to Brooklyn, is instead filled with 50,000 runners. That means the Transit Authority can't collect its usual tolls, which range from $7 to $11, And you think that sounds a little petty? Well, drivers certainly aren't in the mood to be charitable.
The MTA board today officially approved New York's congestion pricing plan.
Earlier this week, the Transit Authority gave its final sign-off to the nation's first congestion pricing plan.
Yes, the plan faces legal challenges, 5 lawsuits to be exact. But most drivers should brace themselves for a $15 toll when entering Manhattan below 60th Street.
Soon, every car will be charged $15 for the privilege of traveling through lower Manhattan. Like, you go on the street, your license plate gets recorded, a bill for $15 shows up in the mail. This has been used in cities like London before. The idea is that drivers will think twice about crowding city streets, and if they do, that money can then be used to make other modes of travel even better. Of course, drivers hate this. They're already charged a ton for parking, they sit in traffic jams, and now they feel like they're being punished for driving their cars at all.
Jersey Congressman Josh Gottheimer said buckle up for the lawsuits and the public outrage because no one messes with Jersey.
Which brings us back to the marathon, because this new plan would basically be congestion pricing for runners. The city saying, we're charging cars for clogging our streets, why do you guys get to shut down a road for free? They've made similar demands now of a popular bike ride across that same bridge. Urban transit activists, though, say city officials are talking out of both sides of their mouth here, because last year, the city thanked the marathon for encouraging tens of thousands of people to take the subway home, bringing in desperately needed subway fares. Ridership has been down most days, so why doesn't that revenue factor into the cost? Also, they say, $750,000, really? Is that how much toll money the bridge makes on one Sunday morning?
If you're running, put your name on your shirt. Mike! Woo! Mike, go! Woo-hoo! Saves that. He loves it.
On the other hand, the marathon could almost certainly foot the bill for something like this by charging runners more. Despite costing $315 per entry, this event sells out every year. There are huge waiting lists. In fact, by the rules of congestion pricing, it makes perfect sense to charge as much as you can and use the profits to better the roads. But at the end of the day, this also might just be a question of what you want to see in your local streets. Which behavior do you reward, and which do you economically punish? If the point of congestion pricing is to make drivers go, maybe this isn't worth it, is our goal also to make joggers use that same logic? Like, which brings more joy to the city, a daily rush hour or a marathon? In other words, do we see every road as a toll road and demand everyone should give it a run for its money? Apparently, they gave the marathon the option to just use the lower deck of the bridge, and the marathon folks were like, okay, but it'll take twice as long to clear everyone off the bridge. You won't have those pretty helicopter shots of everyone smiling and waving, but if that's what you want, if you don't want that good publicity, be my guest. The city then said, actually, let's talk this out. I'm sure we can figure out something. Hey, something super cool. We at Start Here have been nominated for a Webby Award, which celebrates the best stuff on the internet. Specifically, our segment from last year about microplastics in the Great Lakes has been nominated for Best Science and Education Podcasting. We are super psyched about it, and there's an audience vote element to all this. So we are humbly asking for your vote sometime over the next week. Just takes a minute. We will be putting the link to the Webbies in our show notes. If you haven't voted for them before, you do got to set up an account, but I swear it's actually quite painless. You just stick in an email and a password. This link that we're putting in our show notes takes you right there, and we would really appreciate it. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.